This is Big Ideas from the ABC.
I was going to start off by saying how delighted I am to be here. You have to do that, don't you? When you give talks, you have to say how delighted you are to be where you are. I'm not sure, frankly. I had to get up at 5:30 to be here today. I am not delighted about that, frankly. But I'm kind of getting used to this. I was in Oslo recently. Has anybody here been to Oslo? It's an amazing city. I was there. I went to speak at a conference. I flew overnight from Los Angeles. The plane was 5 hours late. And I was driven straight from the airport to the conference. And I walked onto the platform pretty much with my hand baggage, you know. And as I was going on, the woman who'd invited me said, "Have you been to Oslo before?" And I said, "No, never." And I was confident about that, as you might be. Because you don't go to Oslo accidentally, do you? You don't wander in error thinking, "Oh, I was aiming for San Diego, and here we are now in Oslo." So I said, "No, I have not been here before." And then, over dinner with her, I realized that I had been there before. For a week. I'd spent a week there 15 years ago. I was really appalled, not by Oslo, but by that, you know, that you could do that. You know, because if you're in a place for a week, you do things, don't you? I needn't go into all the details about what you do in a week, you know, but you do. You know, you go to bed, you get up, you think Norwegian things. You know, you eat Norwegian food, and generally you bond with the local. I went to the Munch exhibition at the National Gallery, I remember, and saw the screen, which is how I felt, you know, when I realised that I had forgotten the entire trip. Now, I mention it because it may just be me. I mean, it may be that I'm just cracking up, and that's more than likely. But I also think it's a kind of sign of the times. You know, I was born in 1950. And I live now in Los Angeles, but I was born in Liverpool in 1950. And in 1950, nobody went anywhere, really. Nobody travelled. I think the average person in 1950 travelled about 5 miles a day, maximum, if that. You know, they got the bus to work and they came home again. My father never left the north of England. His grandfather never left Liverpool. We were tracing our family tree recently, such as it is. It's kind of more like a shrub, honestly, but with some curious canker on it. We can't work out what the disease is that's affected it. But my brother, I have many brothers, was plotting our family tree, and we realised that all of our great-grandparents. How many great-grandparents do you have? Is it 16 or 8? Do you know?
8.
Good, thank you. Me too. How spooky is that? Really? Have you been to Oslo? Really? I feel it's a bonding moment, don't you, really? We could be relatives. No, all 8 of my great-grandparents were born within 2 miles of each other. When we went around Liverpool looking at the, you know, the old houses, or actually the empty lots where the houses used to be. And if you look at the map, they all lived within a couple of miles of each other. They grew up, that's how they met. You know, they ran into each other in the shops and in the pubs and, you know, the gin halls. And but that's how people did used to meet. You know, communities used to be very tightly bonded, and people married people they ran into in the neighborhood. And I think they kind of settled easily for people. Do you know what I mean? I mean, my great-grandparents were great, but I can't believe that their loves of their lives all happened to live within a square mile of each other, you know, by some curious cosmic quirk. You know, I think people just thought, well, you'll do. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? They ran into me and thought, no, this'll be fine, this'll work, you know. You're not horrible, you know. It'll be fine. You know, because they weren't sitting every week, you know, reading People magazine and Vanity Fair, you know, and thinking, actually, there's all this out there. You know, one of these might turn up. You know, they... I'll hang on. You know, who knows? You know, what might come my way? Well, I say this because all of this has happened in 50 years. Now, we've gone to the point when I now live on the far side of the Earth. My kids have been to, I don't know, I mean, all the continents except Antarctica, I think. And we live in the world that's becoming increasingly frantic and unpredictable. It's hard to grasp how profound this shift is. That we've gone from, I don't mean to say the world used to be a calm, kind of sylvan meadow until recently, but the rate of change was slow by comparison. I used to live in Stratford-on-Avon I used to teach near there. And near Stratford is a village, which is where we actually live, called Snitterfield. Snitterfield, which is a real place, by the way, in case you're thinking I'm just groggy from having been up since 5:30. I shall keep mentioning this 5:30 thing, by the way, really, because it's your fault. I kind of hold you responsible for this, for me getting up. But Snitterfield is where Shakespeare's father was born, John Shakespeare. He never left Snitterfield. Stratford-upon-Avon was 3 miles away. He never left Stratford until he was 36, when it was recorded in the local history books that John Shakespeare left Snitterfield to seek his fortune in Stratford-upon-Avon. You know, he thought, damn it, if not now, when? You know, I'm heading for Stratford and nothing's going to stop me. And he did. The difference is incomparable in not just the lives we live, but the mindsets that we bring to our lives. And I believe that it's catapulting us into, it's not that I believe, I think it's a matter of fact, into a future that none of us can predict with any type of certainty. And I work a lot now in, actually that's a whole sentence there, isn't it, really? I work a lot now. I was watching Victor Borger recently. Do you remember Victor Borger? Isn't he fantastic? I was showing it to my kids. And they always used to end his shows, do you remember? He used to say, I'd like to thank my parents for making this show possible and my children for making it necessary. Oh, that's great. Anyway, I work a lot now in three main areas. I work in education, I always have. I mean, that's my profession, my background. I also work a lot with businesses, with the corporate sector, particularly on issues to do with innovation and creativity. And I work a lot with the cultural sector, and always did. I work with a lot of large and small cultural organizations. And this isn't because I can't settle, you know, it's because I believe that there are synergies in the interests of these different groups, that it's intensely important that we cultivate. And the fact that we don't cultivate them leads to levels of misunderstanding and dissonance between these three areas, which are having chaotic consequences. But the bit I want to focus on is education, because I'd say I work in education quite a bit. And my work in education and actually with organisations is based on three ideas. One of them is this, that we are living in times of revolution. And I believe this is literally true. You know, that I don't mean it figuratively, like it's a bit like a revolution. It's what we think of as a revolution, and what we've come to call a revolution. It is a revolution. A revolution is a time when things you think are obvious turn out not to be. Things that you take for granted turn out to be untrue. Things that you always did habitually turn out to be ineffective. And I believe that's where we are now. And the pace of this is picking up. Secondly, that if we're to meet this revolution, we have to think very differently about ourselves, about our talents and our abilities, and particularly if we have children, we have to think differently about them. I believe that we tragically underestimate the real depth of human talent. I think of this as the other climate crisis. And, you know, we've become used, I hope, to the idea that there is an actual climate crisis in the physical environment. But I believe there's something comparable in the human environment. And there are all ways of calibrating this. I mean, one, for example, is the dropout rate from public schools in America. Now, I ought to say, by the way, that I live in America. I haven't just come over here to take shots, you know, at the education system. We moved out here 9 years ago, my wife and our two kids. We are permanent residents, so there, you know. And we love it here. Actually, we moved here, we moved to Los Angeles, thinking we're moving to America. But I don't know. You've been to Los Angeles, obviously. Have you been to Las Vegas? Have you? What is that? Really? And I'll come back to Las Vegas, so we mustn't get detained. But my wife and I, we've been together for 33 years, Terry and I. Can you blame her? Come on. Would you throw this away? I think not. Anyway. But yes, 33 years I've been under lock and key, and and we've been married for 28, so you can work it out. You know, the first few years were rather torrid, you know, but Terry is a major fan of Elvis Presley. I can't overemphasize what an understatement that is, by the way. There are three of us in this marriage, frankly. Fortunately, I'm alive, you know, but, you know, but it's a marginal advantage, really. But we, 33 is the same look of disappointment at breakfast. It wears you down, you know, but, oh, it's you. Yes, he's dead. Anyway, we went to get married again 3 years ago. It was our 25th wedding anniversary, and we got married again at the Elvis Chapel in Las Vegas. She wanted to be near him, really, so... No, it was a fantastic event, I have to say. It really was good. We had the Blue Hawaii package. But there are others, you know. But with the Blue Hawaii package, you get the Elvis impersonator, four songs, smoke. Now, that was important to me because we'd paid for it. You know, I was distracted during my vows because we hadn't had the smoke. And then it puffed out of an exhaust pipe right above the altar. I thought, that's okay. Check the box. And I think it was to add to the air of mystery and sanctity of the whole occasion, you know. And then, and a hula girl. That was optional. I opted for it, for reasons which I was... reasons I was rather pleased about, frankly. Anyway, no, I mention it because Las Vegas is very curious, as you know. It's curious in all kinds of ways, but the thing that's really curious about Las Vegas to me is this, that there is no reason for it to be there. I mean, if you go to almost any other city on Earth, there's a reason why it is where it is. You know, London is in a natural port. So is New York. Some cities are in great arable plains, so they're good for agriculture, or they're on a crook of a river, so they're good for settlement and for raising crops and families and cattle. No, Los Angeles has a reason to be where it is. You know, it's where the dentists are. You know, people go there naturally, but there is no reason for Vegas to be where it is. If you've been there, you know it's in the middle of a wilderness. There is no natural water supply. In fact, they're running out of water. It's unbearably hot and arid. It's the last place you would put a city, and yet it's one of the fastest growing cities in America. And the reason is, I think, that Las Vegas exemplifies something unique to human beings. Las Vegas is, I mean, actually, Las Vegas exemplifies a lot of things that are unique to human beings, but the particular thing I mean is it exemplifies a unique power that we have. And I believe it's the main distinguishing power that we have that distinguishes from everything else on Earth. I mean, in most respects, we are not distinguished from everything else on Earth. In most respects, we share the same appetites, the same short lifespan, the same needs, the same dependence on the Earth itself as everything else. You know, most of what we think and feel, we owe to things other than our imaginations, I think, other types of impulses. But imagination is what sets us apart. This ability to bring into mind things that aren't present, to hypothesize, to... step outside of the present moment, to move beyond the situation as presented to our senses, and to conceive of alternatives. You see, once you've got imagination, you can look backwards. You can revisit the past, not just any past, but multiple versions of the past. You can rethink the past. You can revisit it, and you can reclaim it. You can put yourself in the minds of other people. You can empathize, a feeling, I believe, that you're rooted in this power of imagination. But you can also visit the future, not the actual future, but you can anticipate it, and with imagination, you can help to bring some of it about. In a biological sense, we're probably not evolving at much more of a rate than everything else on the planet. I don't think we've changed much in my lifetime. I mean, perhaps this generation's getting a bit bigger. We're living a bit longer, some of us. But culturally, we are very different. I mean, dogs, you know, have not evolved in any cultural sense, have they? Recently, I mean, you don't feel you have to keep checking in with dogs, do you, to see what's new? You know, like, what's happening with the dog thing? You know, they are doing much as they always did. But with human beings, there's always something new. There's always something. And this power of originality and of origination derives from this capacity for imagination. Creativity is derived from that too, but it's a different thing, and I want to come to it. But my point in saying this is that this power of imagination is what's driving the revolution. It's what's driven revolutionary movements since the beginning of humanity. It's why we live in cities now and not in caves. It's why we use computers and not flints. It's why we write elaborate novels and don't just whistle. It's because this power has captivated us and drives us forward. But I believe that the process that we might expect to develop this power is failing us in a tragic way. That most people lose touch with their imaginations as they get older. They lose confidence in their creativity. One of the examples is the extraordinary attrition rate in public schools. And I say I live here, so I haven't come to take shots of this. But in America now, and it's not unlike other parts of the world, by the way, there is a 30%, you know this, an average 30% dropout rate from public education. 30%. Millions of kids who go into the system and never complete it. And countless more who stay with the system but don't engage with it, who detach from it in some way, who get through it but don't feel they benefit from it. And there are other indices. One of them, by the way, in California, where I live, is that in California this year, the state government of California is on track to spend more money on the correctional system than on the whole of public higher education. I mean, does that answer to any conception of humanity that you could bear to live with? You know, that there are more potential criminals in the state of California than potential college graduates. I don't mean to imply these are mutually exclusive groups, by the way. I mean, in my experience, there's a good deal of overlap. But what I mean is the idea that we're better investing in correctional systems than in developing the powers that may encourage people to avoid being in them in the first place seems to me to be absolutely absurd. I just don't believe it. You know, I just don't believe there are that many bad people. You know, there aren't that many psychopaths, I think. Actually, you don't need that many, do you? Really? I mean, one goes a long way, don't you find, really? I mean, like, if you meet two psychopaths in one day, this is a bad day, isn't it, frankly? But so I believe there's a crisis of human resources. And thirdly, that if we're to meet this crisis, we have to behave differently. We have to do different things. We have to act differently. And I believe this is especially true of education. There are reform movements in education all over the world. That's why I was in Oslo, I remembered. It's not just in America. It's every country on earth currently is trying to reform its education system. And my view is that reform doesn't work. That we have to go further than reform. We have to be looking at transformation rather than reformation. And the reason is this, that our education systems are derived from another age. Most of our education systems came into being in their structure in the 19th century. They are modeled on the interests and needs of industrialism. I know that Richard Florida has written about this and maybe talked about it this morning. That in the structure of education, we see the industrial system replicated. And I can give you some examples of it. It's a very linear system. You know, the assumption is if you work hard at school and go through the system and do everything that's required of you, and especially if you get a college degree, that you will be set for life. Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, that when I was growing up, that was the story. You know, that if you went to college and got a degree, you were absolutely guaranteed a job. There's no guarantee for that now. I work a lot with companies and organizations. If you run one, I mean, are you impressed if somebody turns up with a college degree? I mean, do you immediately show them the corner office and say, well, here you are, you know, the very person we've been waiting for, you know, your people will be assembling shortly? I think not. You see, the only reason in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, the only reason you would not have a job if you had a college degree would be if you didn't want a job. And I left college in 1972, and I didn't want a job. I was trying to find myself in 1972. You could do this then, do you remember? I thought, no, I have to search my inner being before I get down to, you know, avoiding living off my parents. And no, so I decided to go to India, where I thought I might be. And I didn't get to India, by the way. I got to London. Well, to be fair, there are a lot of Indian restaurants. No, but I hung out there. But I knew that when I wanted a job, I would just pop out and get one, because I had a degree. It's not true now. A degree, you may be better off with a degree, but there's no guarantee. It's been said, you know, a degree used to be a passport to employment, and now it's a visa. You know, get you in for a bit. This is not because standards are falling. I don't know if they are or not. I don't think anybody really knows if they are or not, taken as a whole. It's because the world has shifted on its axis. And one factor is that more and more people are getting degrees because of the growth of the knowledge economy, the things that Richard Florida has written about. That the shift in the fundamental economic basis of the workforce has generated a need for more and more people to be educated to higher and higher levels. And I mean, see, when I went to college, about 1 in 20 people went to college, because about 1 in 20 people ended up doing office work. About 80% of people did manual work or blue-collar work, and others did kind of routine admin. Now, it's a much higher proportion. About 1 in 3 people go to college. Well, the result of it is that academic qualifications are falling in value. I mean, they may still be worth doing from a personal point of view, and I wouldn't talk anybody out of going to college. But I also wouldn't talk anybody into it either. I do think it's an obsession that we have that everybody has to go to college or their life ends. And I know people who have perfectly wonderful lives who never went to college and never wanted to go to college. And kids who've gone to college who wish they'd never gone, and who go through 4 years but still don't know what to do next. But it's become an algorithm that you have to go through the system exactly as it's laid out, or the world will come to a sudden end. So there's a linear model here. The second is that it's about conformity. It's about batching. You know, we still educate people by age group, for example. Why do we do that? I mean, it's because it's a managerial convenience. It's not because it answers to any model of human growth or development. You know, but we assume that all the 5-year-olds should be educated together, all the 6-year-olds, all the 7-year-olds. It's like the most important thing they have in common is their date of manufacture. You know, well, I know 5-year-olds who are a lot smarter than some 12-year-olds, according to what they're doing. And it's also about standardization. We know this. And, you know, the great blight, I believe, particularly on American education, if I could say so just now, is this obsession with standardizing everything, the cult of standardized tests. Now, there's a lot in all of these things, but transformation essentially to me means changing the paradigm. And a paradigm is really a set of ideas and assumptions that we take for granted on which we build our theories. Probably the best example that springs to mind is the Copernican Revolution in the Middle Ages. You know, up until Copernicus, all of the astronomers and mathematicians and scientists and philosophers believed, or acted as if they believed, that the sun revolved around the earth. And all of their calculations were based on that. And also that the movements were perfectly spherical. And this wasn't just a scientific premise, it was a religious conviction. Because the assumption was that human beings were the center of God's universe and nature's last word, and everything else revolved around us. And also, it answered to common sense. You know, it was clear that the planets were moving and that we weren't. You know, I mean, people were not spinning off the earth, you know, every day. You know, they weren't stumbling on the way to work because of the sudden spinning movements of the planet. It was clear the earth was still, to common sense. The problem was there are lots of anomalies in the observations of astronomers. The planets wouldn't behave. You know, they kept describing odd elliptical movements in the sky. And mathematicians came up with more and more elaborate explanations for why it might be. Copernicus said, well, maybe, you know, just for the sake of argument, what if the sun is not going around the Earth? What if we're going around the sun? How would it look then? And many of the old problems disappeared at a stroke. And he was persecuted, of course, for his efforts. Because this wasn't just a scientific premise, it was an offence to theology and to common sense. Of course, we now take it for granted that he was right. The Copernican revolution wasn't a new theory, it was a new ideology, it was a new paradigm. What happens is, in paradigm shifts, typically, I think, is that the adherents of the old paradigm cling onto it as if their life depends upon it, because it's all they know. And they believe the problem is just it's not working as well as it used to, we just need to fix it. And the same thing is happening now as we speak in education. People who are invested in the old paradigm are clinging onto it as if their life depends upon it. And the fact is, it can't be fixed as it is, because the basic premises of it are mistaken. It's based on a faulty view of the economy and a mistaken conception of human ability. And the consequence of this is not only that people aren't getting jobs with degrees, there's a mounting skills gap among people who don't have degrees. The long-term unemployed are finding that more and more the things they've been educated to do don't apply. You may have seen some of this, the pieces in the New York Times this last week about the growing skills gap in the attempts to revive the economy. Literally tens of thousands of people are unable to find work, though the numbers of jobs are growing, because there's no match between what they're capable of doing and the jobs that are needed. So it's an economic problem at both ends of the system. But it's also an existential problem for the people who are in the system. I published a book last year, actually 18 months ago. Do you care when it was? Does it matter to you? Okay, January of last year. The 23rd, is it? Anyway, this book, it's called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And I have to tell you that this book is terrific. Really, honestly. You'd be mad not to buy this book, honestly, really. But it's based on this. It's based on an observation I've made, I'm sure you've made for a long time, is that an awful lot of people, I don't know if that's statistically accurate enough for you, but lots of people, you know, we're talking huge numbers here, an egregiously large number of people, do not enjoy what they do for a living. You know it. You may be one of them. I know all kinds of people who don't like what they do for a living. They may be good at it. They don't particularly relish doing it. They've just wandered into doing it. And they get on with it. And largely wait for the weekend. They, so to speak, endure what they do rather than enjoy it. But I also meet people, and always have done, a smaller group of people, I have to say, who love what they do, and who couldn't imagine doing anything else. And if you said to them, why don't you change track and do something else? They'd look at you as if you'd gone mad, because they'd say, but you know, this is who I am. You know, this isn't just what I do. This defines me. You know, I am this. You know, I am a chemist. You know, I am a chef. You know, I am a fireman. You know, I am a teacher. That's who I am. This is what I live for. And if I were not to do this, I don't know what I would do. You know what I'm talking about here, don't you? The common language of this is that they are in their element. You know, that, and what we mean in common language is if you're in your element, you're feeling at your most authentic, your most comfortable, your most genuine version of yourself. There's an old Native American story I was told a while ago in Oklahoma of two fish, two young fish that were swimming along the river. Actually, in the river. And an old fish swam in the opposite direction. And the old fish nodded to the two young fish and said, good morning, boys. And they nodded. And said, how's the water? And then swam on. And when they got a bit further down the river, one of the young fish turned to the other one and said, what's water? Because they had no idea that that's what they were in, the element on which they depended. And people I know who are doing their life's work, so to speak, so much take for granted this is what they should be doing that they couldn't even distinguish themselves from the work in some ways. It defines them. Now, most people in my experience are not in that place. I believe we all have the potential to be in that place. Ironically, one of the reasons we're not in that place is education. Because our education systems are based not on a broad, encompassing conception of intelligence and ability, but on a narrow view of ability and intelligence. And the consequence of that is that we've created all kinds of ways of promoting some sense of normality and stigmatizing people who deviate from it. Can I ask you something? How many of you here are baby boomers? Oh, welcome. If you can bear to put your hands up again, I know it's the end of the day, but no, not yet. No, I haven't, not yet. You've shown you can do that, you know, really. We're beyond the poo stage now, I think, really. I'll ask you this question and then you can... In a minute, would you put your hands up if you've had your tonsils removed? Right, now that's a lot of us, isn't it? You see, baby boomers and our parents, but particularly baby boomers... By the way, you've not been asked that recently, have you? That doesn't come up socially, does it? You know, people don't come up and say, you must be Andrew, do you have your tonsils? It doesn't happen, does it? I mention it for this reason. See, when I was growing up, kids of my generation routinely had their tonsils taken out. Isn't this true? Routinely. The minute you showed signs of a sore throat, somebody would pounce on you and take your tonsils out. Didn't they? They did. When I was a teenager, you couldn't afford to clear your throat in public. Somebody would grab you and take your tonsils out. And very possibly adenoids too. In fact, any protuberance they couldn't account for would be removed. No. Millions of tonsils were removed in the 50s and 60s, were they not? What happened to all the tonsils? I mean, it's a scandal, I believe. Anyway, but you see, now the thing is, most of these operations were unnecessary. Most of them are unnecessary. Children today, young people today, do not suffer from this plague. This was a plague that was visited on a whole generation. It was a fad. It was a fashion that doctors, you know, were paid to remove tonsils. It was kind of conventional wisdom. They had to come out that you didn't need the tonsils anyway. Let's just remove them, get rid of them. You're better off without them. And the result was that lots of us have been going around, you know, I have my tonsils, by the way, in case you're interested. I kept my mouth shut as a kid. But I spoke through my teeth for about 15 years. Kids today don't suffer from this because medicine has moved on and doctors have taken a different view and they've come to the opinion that there are dangers in removing tonsils and anyway, it's not necessary. And so it doesn't happen. People are treated with antibiotics or they're left alone to recover in their own way. This generation of kids has avoided the false plague of tonsillectomies. But I believe they're subject to another plague that we didn't have to go through. A plague that's equally fallacious, that is extravagantly overestimated, and is causing misery, I think, to lots of kids. What I mean is the plague of ADHD. Now, I don't mean to say that there is no such thing as ADHD. I'm not qualified to say that. It's not my field. But I've spoken to lots of people whose field it is. There's a general view that there is such a thing. It's not a single thing, that there is a kind of complex of conditions that are broadly called ADHD. It shows itself in different ways. I think what we also know is, though, that children, young people, like adults, are tremendously diverse. And they think in all kinds of ways. The idea of intelligence being multifaceted has become, I think, now properly part of mainstream thinking in lots of fields of education, primarily, I have to say, through the work of Howard Gardner, who's also here, who has, I think, promulgated this idea in the most extraordinary way. And it answers to common sense that human intelligence is extraordinarily diverse. And we don't just live in a kind of calm state of academic detachment. We are embodied people. We live in bodies, and our bodies and our minds are infused constantly with feelings and emotions and moods and states of mind. It is the nature of a human being to be active and to be creative and to be intellectually restless. But a lot of kids are being subjected to this conformist form of education that's obsessed with standardization, finding it hard to keep with it, can't keep with the program because the program is so dull. And one of the answers we've now come up with is to sedate them to keep them with the program, to promote a sense of normality for those who seem to deviate from it. Now, as I say, I don't mean to say there's no such thing as it, but I believe if we've developed education systems in which we can only command people's attention by anesthetizing them, then it's time we rethought some of the basic premises. You see, one of the most powerful feelings we all have is a sense of aesthetic pleasure. An aesthetic pleasure is one in which we are alive with the power of the present moment, where we are exhilarated by the sensory pleasure of sounds or of sights or of food or of nature, but an intense sense of being alive, of being conscious. The opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. An anesthetic is something you take to dull your senses so you can cope with the discomfort. And I believe this is the effect we're having. And by the way, a lot of these drugs now, which are being prescribed like candy, are circulating through our systems of higher education as high-performance drugs so that people can get the degree they think is going to get them a job later on. We've created a monstrous situation here, I think, in our misuse of human resources. And when we talk about getting back to basics, I think that's exactly what we have to do. We have to rethink some of the things that we have come to take for granted about the nature of intelligence and ability and the relationship of feelings to intelligence and the body to the mind and so on. Now, the element is an attempt to do that. When I say that being in your element, it means doing something for which you have a natural feel. There's more to it than that. I mean, you have to sympathize. I had a whole book to write about this. You know what I mean? I can't dismiss it in a single sentence like this. You know, there's much more about it than this. There are really four things to think about, I believe, in relation to the element, about why some people find it and some don't. And I just want to mention them in outline, say what I think it might mean for education, and then we're going to open this up for some conversation. To be in your element, I believe, is at least this. Firstly, if you're in your element, you're doing something for which you have a natural aptitude, a natural feel, like you get it. One of the people I included in the book, I didn't meet him, but I hope to, is a guy called Terence Tao. Have you heard of Terence Tao? Any of you? Check him out. Terence Tao is a professor of mathematics at UCLA. He's recognized generally in the field to be the most gifted mathematician on Earth currently. He's referred to by other mathematicians as the Mozart of math. He should come to the Aspen Ideas Festival. He's a remarkable guy. At the age of 3, he was doing double-digit equations. At the age of 2, apparently, he taught himself to read from watching Sesame Street. So he has a rather curious accent, you know, as a consequence. You know. Hey, you know. Rather too fond of feathers for most people's taste. There you go. At the age of 8, he took a college entrance math exam and got 98%. At the age of 20, he got his PhD in pure math. At the age of 30, he was awarded the Field Medal for mathematics, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize. It's reasonable to say, isn't it, that Terence gets math. You know, I think Terence has got it down, you know, the math thing. But you see, a lot of people don't get it down. A lot of people don't get math. I never particularly got math at school. I know a lot of kids who don't get it. And I think it's okay if you don't get it. I think you should try hard, like everything else, and try and get things. I don't mean you should back away from things that are difficult. The problem, though, is, in schools, that we very often judge everybody by their abilities in math and conclude if they're not good at that, then they're just not good. You know, it leads to a curious inversion here. Our schools operate on a very narrow conception of ability. It's largely a preoccupation with a certain type of academic ability, a certain type of propositional knowledge. It's why kids spend so much time writing essays, you know, and doing analytical pieces. And think how much time you spent at school doing that stuff. Not saying it's not important, but it's established a view of intelligence, which is rather narrow. And the consequence is that our view of disability is correspondingly large. Our view of ability has created an extraordinarily expansive disability. I used to work in special needs education, And I know that very often kids who have sensory impairments have profound abilities in other ways, which they can't access or can't articulate because they have a problem perhaps in speaking or in writing. But the problem very often is kids with a physical disability are branded as being disabled in general. It becomes their brand rather than a feature of part of what they are like. So a lot of kids, you know, are stigmatized because they're not particularly good at math, and they're often led to believe they're not good at something else. But I don't speak in criticism of math. Terence Tao and others are brilliantly good. I know lots of people who just get what they do. It may be dance, it may be music, it may be chemistry, it may be working with people. But being good at something is not enough to be in your element. Because I know lots of people who are good at things they don't care for. You know, they just do it. To be in your element, you have to love it. And if you love something you're good at, you know, you never work again at that point. You know, your life comes to a place that you never want to leave. My brother, I have, I say, lots of brothers, one of my other brothers, I have five, used to be in bands. He still is. He's in rock bands. And I remember in the, I don't know, 70s, 80s, he was in a particular band, and I went to see them, and they were fantastic. They had a keyboard player called Chaz. He was about 25. Fantastic keyboard player. And I was hanging out at the gig, as we call it in the music business, you know, grooving. And I did not look then as I look now, by the way. The suave sophisticate you see before you. I was channeling Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. You know, I had the blonde hair, the leather jacket, and the blue jeans. You know, I was almost dangerously attractive at this point. You know? And I was, if I say so myself, which is the only plausible explanation for why so many women avoided me, I think. But anyway, but I was hanging out at this bar, watching the band, and Chaz came off stage, the whole band did, and we're having a drink. And I said to him, "You were fantastic tonight." He said, "Well, thank you very much." I said to him, "You know, I'd love to do that." He said, "Do what?" I said, "To play like that." He said, "No, you wouldn't." Well, I was taken aback, frankly, because I was just socializing. You see what I mean? It wasn't there to be interrogated or challenged. You know, so I persisted like you do. You know, I thought, no, I'll keep on with this. I know what I think. So I said, "Well, I would." And he said, "No, you wouldn't." And we went on in this way for some time until the barman intervened and said, "Would one of you move this on a bit?" So I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, look, I play keyboards for a living. I've been playing keyboards since I was a kid. I started when I was six. I practice 6 hours a day, and I play five nights a week." And he said, "And I do that." He said, "If I'm any good, it's because I do that, because I put all that work in." And he said, "And I put all that work in because I love it. I love it." And he said, "If you loved it, you'd be doing it." He said, "I think what you mean is you like the idea of it." I said, "Don't you speak to me like this. I mean, I could be a VIP at some point, for all you know." But of course, he's right. You know, if I'd love it, I'd be doing it. Loving it is crucial. But the thing about this is, you see, that what it comes to me, is a fundamental principle, which is this, that the reason our education systems are failing is because the premise on which they are based, not the organizational premise, but the premise about what it is to be a person, is faulted. You see, when politicians come to talk about education, and that's true whether you're looking at No Child Left Behind or Race for the Top, they're all cut from the same cloth, really. When they come to talk about education and improving it, which they should, the premise is that improving education is a bit like bailing out the auto industry. You know, we just have to get more efficient, we need to get rid of the nonsense, you know, we have to face up to overseas competition, make sure standards are set and we all keep to them, and that people have real incentives to make sure there's a proper return on investment. All the language is language you would apply to manufacturing things. The difficulty is this, that human beings are not things. Motor cars have no interest in how they're made, and human beings do. Human beings are full of feelings and intuitions and values and relationships and ideas and aspirations and imagination. And you cannot educate people if you don't engage with them as people. If we overlook the personal character of education, nothing else works. It can't work. It's implausible that it would work. You know, there isn't a kid in the country, I think, who gets out of bed first thing in the morning thinking, what can I do to raise the state's reading standards? You know, call me, you know, I'm at your disposal. My only wish is to serve. Kids are motivated by their own interests and their own passions. Now, I don't mean by this some limp conception of making everything relevant to them or of just following their interest. The point I'm making is that all children are unique and different. How many of you here have got two children? Now, I bet you, I don't have to place the bet, that they are completely different, aren't they? Even identical twins end up being different because they are all unique moments in history, as you are. And they're driven by unique interests and unique passions. And they are the people at the heart of the system who we are trying to educate. And we can't do it if we don't engage them personally, each and every one of them. There is no other way. What happens if we don't is we have a 30% attrition rate of people who decide it's just not for them. And interestingly, all the remedial programs that are designed to get them back in the system are based on personalizing education to them. And if we would personalize it in the first place, they probably wouldn't have dropped out. Now, what it also points to is this, that the principle of linearity is itself wholly faulted when it comes to human life. Human life is not linear any more than it's impersonal. It's organic. And I'll just give you an example to lead us into this conversation. Have you heard of a guy called Bart Connor? Bart Connor, some of you may know. Bart Connor is in the book, The Element. And Bart Connor, when he was six, he lived in Morton Grove, Illinois. And he found that he could walk on his hands as easily as he could walk on his feet. Now, he can't remember how he found this out. This is lost to history, but he did. And I've seen him do it. He does it in restaurants. It's all rather awkward, you know. But he will walk up and down confidently and indefinitely on his hands. Well, he said it wasn't much use, you know, as a six-year-old, you know, but, you know, it got him attention, and so he kept doing it. And then he found he could walk up and down stairs on his hands. And again, he said it wasn't much use, you know, but whenever there was a party at home, and the conversation lulled, you know, his father would say, Bart, just do the hands thing that way, you know. And the conversation picked up again. Anyway, nobody thought much of this except his mother. And his mother took him to the local gymnasium in Morton Grove, Illinois. And he said, I will never forget the moment when I walked into the gymnasium. He said it was intoxicating. I said, what, in what way? He said it was like Santa's Grotto and Disneyland all in one place. He said there were wall bars, there were ropes, there were trampolines, there were vaulting courses. He said it was intoxicating. Now, I pause to ask you this question. I mean, is that how you feel when you walk into a gymnasium? Now, you might. I'm not saying none of you does. You might, but I don't. I do not find it intoxicating, honestly. I need to get intoxicated if I get within 50 yards of a gymnasium. But anyway, but Bart loved it. And he went every day because he loved it. And 10 years later, he walked onto the mat at the Montreal Olympics representing the United States in the male gymnastics team. He went on to be the most decorated male gymnast in American history. He lives now in Norman, Oklahoma. He's married to Nadia Comaneci. You remember? First perfect 10. They have a wonderful little boy called Dylan, after Bob Dylan. Why not Bob? We don't know. That's what comes of spending your life upside down, no doubt. But anyway, he and Nadia are members of the board of the Special Olympics movement, a movement which has so far involved 30 million people with special needs in high-level athletic activities. And between them, they've helped to liberate the physical capabilities of literally millions of people. Now, none of that would have happened if Bart's mother had not taken him to the gymnasium. See, she could have said to him when Bart was six, "Bart, will you stop it with the hands thing? Like, you know, knock it off and do what you're meant to be doing. It's kind of embarrassing, you know?" But she didn't. She encouraged him because she looked into his eyes and saw that this somehow characterized him, that this was answering to a need he had that was distinctive to him. And we all have those. Our children are giving us signals all the time about who they are, the things they're drawn to, the things that attract their attention, the things that attract their interest. You have been giving those signals out yourself your entire life, things that you are naturally drawn to, but you may have denied yourself access to it by now and think, well, it's too late, or I won't, or it won't work anymore, or you were turned away at the time from something, maybe. But the other thing is that even though she encouraged him, she could not have anticipated the outcome, could she? All she could do is start him on the journey. She could not have foreseen the life he was going to lead. I'm sure she didn't think, you know, Bart six, here we are in Morton Grove, Illinois. I gather there's this girl in Romania, you know. You know, if we move things around, you never know. Because life is not linear, it's organic. What happens when you invest in your own interests and talents is your life changes. Other people come into your life, you have different experiences, you engage with yourself differently, and your relationships with other people change their lives too, and they change the course of what you do. It's a synergistic process of being alive. And what we've bequeathed on our children is an inert system of linear planning which has its roots in the imperatives of manufacturing, not in the principles and ethics of the organic process of being alive in the world. Now, the old system is based on a meeting point of an economic imperative and a model of intelligence. We have a different set of economic circumstances now, a different set of cultural imperatives, and the only way we'll meet them is by investing properly in the things that make us distinctively human, the powers of imagination and creativity, and finding those talents and abilities in ourselves that make us who we are. And this isn't some loose liberal idea. The only way we'll cope with the future is by recognizing that we are a part of shaping it. And to make it work, we have to have all our wits about us and to celebrate the real principle of ecology, which is diversity and the dynamism of different ways of thinking coming together and creating something fresh and new. Now, this is not a romantic idea. This can be done. In fact, it's the only way it ever works. I know great schools all across this country, and every one of them is based on customizing the curriculum to those kids. It's based on encouraging the creative capabilities of the teachers in the system. It's based on the engagement with the community, and it's based on a recognition the curriculum itself has to be broad enough to encompass the broad range of abilities that the children bring with them naturally to school. It's not a way of avoiding the issue, it's the only way to engage with the issue. And I believe, by the way, we could make this transformation begin tomorrow. Often, I think people believe we have to wait for the government to do something. This government, any government. And that we look for a single model that we can apply across the whole system. That's not how nature works. It's not how ecology works. All the great schools I know are great because they meet standards. But every one of them is different. And they're different because they're rooted in local circumstances. And I believe we can make the change beginning tomorrow, providing the principles are right. And by the way, the principles are out there. They are running through all the conversations at Aspen. They're running through the way the culture is forming itself anyway. I think what a great organization like this can do, a great meeting point of people like this is, can do, is promulgate a different type of conversation. And if we can do that, I believe that we'll find there'll be a new harvest of human achievement that we would find it hard to anticipate, but on which we will depend. Thank you. So much for the introduction. So, I think we've got a couple of minutes, if you're on for it, if you've got time, for some questions. Where are the microphones? Can I, Matt, there's a lady here, I think, would like to ask a question.
I'm Ginny Galisa now, and I'm wondering, Why do some people not find their passion? And then when those do find their passion, what keeps them from manifesting it?
Okay. There are all kinds of reasons, I think. Actually, I have a chapter in the book. No, it's called What Will They Think? And I think broadly they come into these categories. Some of it is personal. People censor themselves. They worry that they will fail if they try it. They doubt their own abilities, though they don't feel they're entitled to it. They feel that they would be wasting their time or that the moment's passed. So self-doubt is a big issue. And almost everyone I interviewed in the book, and I interviewed lots of people, found some way of dealing with self-doubt. Either they were impelled because they saw no alternative, or they thought, well, why wouldn't I? You know, if not now, when? I mentioned that there are four things of the element. One is attitude, one is aptitude, one is passion, the third is attitude, and the fourth is opportunity. There can be really serious social constraints. You know, our friends and families have an opinion about us that we respond to. You might say to somebody close to, I'm thinking of doing this, and they go, really? What, you? You know, and it can be as little as a raised eyebrow that will put you off. There may be actual cultural constraints. You know, for a long time, and in some cultures still, there are very clear views about what's appropriate for people of certain ages or of genders. You know, that you have to fight a wall of cultural resistance to do certain things. So there are many of them. The thing is to decide in your own life what it is that's stopping you. Yes.
Is there not also an economic dimension to this? Because I think about like my father. He was an orphan, and so when he was getting out of the workaday world, he didn't have a lot of choices. At least he didn't see the world as a world abundant with choices. So how does economy factor into the thoughts that you shared?
Oh, hugely it does. Yeah, I mean that was true of my parents. You know, my father wanted to be a professional soccer player. But, you know, he wasn't allowed to. He left school at 14, you know, and his parents required of him that he earned money and contribute to the household. And at the time, soccer players weren't paid any money, you know, so there's no doubt of it. And there are real economic constraints for many people, even now. I mean, we get used to, as we live in America, in some of the affluent circumstances that many people here probably enjoy, to think this is the way it is everywhere. Of course, it's not. I mean, most people are living in desperate poverty. Or close to the borderline of it. So there are real economic constraints. But I don't think they're enough, honestly, because this isn't necessarily about doing this for a living. You know, I won't keep saying I have a chapter in the book about this, but I have a chapter in the book about this, which is called For Love or Money. I know lots of people who are fulfilling themselves, doing things they love to do, but don't want to do it for a living. They would rather not. It would put too much pressure on them, too much strain. It's not what they get from it in the first place. Or they may not be able to. But I do know that when people have confidence and invest in their own interests and talents, that their lives are transformed nonetheless. You know, there's also a great movement just now in amateurism, in the best sense of the term. You know, an amateur has a bad press because people contrast amateur with professional and think amateur means non-professional. But in its original meaning, it means somebody who does it for the love of it, an amateur. It's from amour. So I think that there is an economic imperative, and again, you have to ask what it is. I mean, I have them in my life. You know, I have kids, we have families. You know, my wife and I have to make our own living, and we have to, you know, we have bills to pay too. So this isn't to say this is something you can, you know, apply only if you're comfortable or you've reached retirement age. On the contrary, but I do think it's important. It's about tapping into the full range of people's talents. And the thing as well, you know, about it, from an economic point of view, the current system is disastrous. The cost of mopping up disaffection and disillusion of remedial programs, the costs of keeping people kind of sedated is huge. You know, the cost of keeping somebody in a jail, for example, compared to the cost of educating them is ridiculously expensive. I remember I was in Hong Kong. I do remember being there a while ago. I was speaking at the same conference with Sarah Palin. I gave a keynote the first day, and she spoke on the second day. And I shall pass over this now. But it was a room full of investors. And I was having a go at the fast food industry. And this woman stood up and said, you know, you may knock the fast food industry, you know, but it's very cheap and it's very profitable. It's a good investment. And I said, you know, the thing is, it's neither. It's neither cheap, nor really in the long term is it profitable. Because, you know, you may be able to buy a burger for a dollar, but the cost environmentally and ecologically of the fast food industry is overtaking the planet. You know, we're about to pay a huge price for the way that we've devastated the environment in the interest of this stuff. And also, it's contributing to the worst and most expensive outbreak of diabetes and obesity in the history of humanity. So where's cheap in this? You know, where is cheap? And that's what I feel happens in education. You know, we go for cheap options, and they turn out to be much more expensive than getting it right in the first place. But you're right, so the economic argument to me is a very powerful one. It's an important one. Yes?
And where would you suggest a curriculum and raise the
individual's
passion? Where would you find a curriculum? You mentioned there are a lot of schools
that
are along the lines of what you're discussing.
Yes.
In the United States. I'm just curious what a curriculum looks like that allows kids...
Okay. Well, there are many. There's a very good scheme in Oklahoma called A-plus schools. Time is short, I just pick one out. It's Oklahoma and Arkansas. I've been helping with a program in Oklahoma for the past 3 years called the Oklahoma Creativity Project. Oklahoma is the youngest state in the union, and it's made, you know, its name through minerals and agriculture, but they know that in the long term, those resources will run out. So they're looking to reinvent themselves in their second century. And I was asked to get involved and help them think about this, which I've been doing. And we have something called the Oklahoma Creativity Project. They want to become the creative, they want to be seen as the state of creativity. Now, I'll tell you, when I say this outside of America, that Oklahoma wants to be the creative state, people go, really? In America, people go, really? And I say, yes, really. It's very interesting. There is a whole network of creative districts around the world, about 16 of them, and Oklahoma is the only American state representing the network. And there is an event happening in November, which I encourage you to take an interest in, called the World Creativity Forum, where all these different districts are coming together to meet in Oklahoma City for a week. And it's shaping up to be a great event. Anyway, so it's why I know about A-plus schools and other ones there. There are lots. There are common principles that underpin them too. What I'd like to, by the way, you give me a steer on this. I have a short video. It's like 5 minutes. But I think you might like it. It's, do you know the Blue Man Group?
Yes.
I've been doing some work with the Blue Man Group latterly. They're wonderful people. And they asked that same question, essentially. The three founders, you probably haven't seen them without the makeup on, have you? But the three founders of the group, Matt and Chris and Phil, they got together. That's a great example of non-linearity. You know, they got together probably 20 years ago now. And Phil and Chris met because they were both working as dishwashers in the same restaurant. That's how they met. You know, the supervisors, when Phil turned up, said, go and work with him, he'll show you what to do. That's how two-thirds of the Blue Man Group met. And they were doing street theatre, and they had this idea to paint themselves blue. They can't remember why blue or who had the idea. But they said, it's very interesting that you would never have seen that as much of a business proposition. You know, that we'll go bold and blue, you know, and take the world by storm. But they've actually now built a global brand. There are Blue Man shows in, I think, 12 cities. And a whole range of creative industries that have come off the back of the Blue Man Group. But they're all married now to three great girls, and they have got children. They all work together now, all six of them. And they've got children, and they said, well, what are we going to do with our kids? Because none of them, when it came to it, had really felt happy about their own education. And they looked at the schools available in their area of New York and thought, well, we don't like these much either, actually. So they thought, well, we'd better start a school. So they've founded the Blue School, which is a school for little ones at the moment. It's sort of pre-K and kindergarten, but they eventually will develop into a K-12 school. So they've made this short video, it's about 5 minutes, just describing how they got to create the school you can see something of the school, but also because they talk about the element and how it's affected their lives. Would you like to see it?
Yes.
And then, so could we run the video and then we'll all go and have a drink, I expect. I'll just say a few words before it's finished, but yes, please. Have a drink, I expect. I'll just say a few words before it's finished, but yes, please.
Blue Man Group first started, we weren't a business, we weren't a company, we weren't a show, we were just a community of friends looking for something interesting to do. All we had was a character and a few principles that we shared, we talked about. We had no idea what we were going to do. We just knew that we were going to explore these ideas using this character. So one of the ideas was that we all could be creative. We needed that idea because we had gone through our educational experience thinking maybe we weren't creative. And then we got together and said, well, maybe that's not true. What if that isn't true?
It was a really important principle to start with, and it's influenced everything throughout our career, really.
Being creative wasn't necessarily confined to if you could mold clay or paint on a canvas or write music, you know, that anything that you did, that in the business setting you could be creative. Anything you bring your own creativity to in any discipline is an act of creativity.
And I think one thing that really led to is that there's no separation. There's a consciousness about the way you approach everything.
Our story is proof that Sir Ken Robinson is right. If ordinary people find their element, extraordinary things can happen. And there's actually a piece in our show that's a little bit of a metaphor for our journey to finding our element. There's one of the Blue Men plays around with making a painting, and he takes to it very quickly. The other Blue Man tries to follow the same path, and that doesn't quite work out for him as well. He struggles for a little while, just like we've struggled to find our own element. Some people are lucky and they want to be rocket scientists or cellists, and these are existing media. And for us, we wanted to be postmodern multimedia vaudevillians who create instruments and explore pop culture in a sort of shamanic primal atmosphere. Where does that job exist? You know, because if we could have found it, we would have signed up for that.
We're always jealous of people who find their calling easily. Things just spin into place for them, kind of like the Blue Men on the left. We're more like the Blue Men on the right. We were confused by what life was throwing at us. How would we combine all of our different interests together into one art form? At a certain point, you just need to take the leap. No matter how ugly it is or how unlikely it may seem, you've got to try to follow your creative instincts and not worry about what it looks like or how much money it's worth.
One thing that drew us together initially, even before there was a Blue Man, is that we were in our own ways disappointed with our educational experience. And that's one reason why we wanted to start a school. We wanted to create the kind of school that we would have loved to have gone to.
We wanted to make a school that either we wished we had gone to or that we fantasized would be the school for our children. And that's a school that had, as Sir Ken Robinson talks so much about, emphasizes creativity as much as any other subject. Teaches kids a special way to treat one another, a social-emotional learning, is a place where you don't lose your childlike exuberance, where you have such a zest for learning, a love of life all the way through, not having it educated out of you.
On a kind of metaphorical level, the traditional model of education is that children are freight cars and the school is a grain silo and it's just going to fill each kid up and then move them down the track. And we're interested in creating a launch pad where kids are the rockets and we're just there trying to find the fuse.
We knew we wanted to create a school that a big part of it was actually teaching kids how they think, teaching them a level of self-awareness that we felt was missing from our educational experience.
I think it involves having the entire brain just really alive and exhilarated and tingling with life force. And that needs to be part of our educational model. I mean, that seems like a crazy revolutionary idea, but it really actually seems to us that it makes sense. It makes actual academic sense.
You know, it seems like when we're all kids, at one time, like, everybody paints. But somehow we throw away that kind of inspiration in the moment, and we get rid of a bunch of other things, too.
We tend to think that the part of ourselves that feels different should be hidden. I mean, covered up. And I think what the Blue Man message is that, you know, do not hide that, because that part of you is the key to, you know, one's individuality, but also like letting it out lets all this creativity out. You know, having the courage to expose that part of yourself. When we drum on the paint, the vibrant color is a way of expressing the vibrance that happens when you let your outsider come out.
That's great. Great little movie, isn't it? I jotted it down. I thought it was great. Chris said this about what they wanted to be. He said, "We wanted to be postmodern, multimedia vaudevillians who create instruments and explore pop culture in a shamanic primal atmosphere." He said, "Where's that job?" The thing is, of course, a lot of the jobs our kids will be doing haven't been invented yet. Nobody's thought of them yet, you know, but they will if we allow them to do it. And I came across a great quote just from thinking what you were just saying there. Two, really, I thought I'd leave you with. One was from Henry David Thoreau, who said that we should all aim to dwell as near as possible to the channel in which your life flows. And a lot of this is finding other people who are taking the same journey, connecting with people who feel as you do. But this thing about fear was addressed by Teilhard de Chardin, who said, "Instead of standing on the shore and convincing ourselves that the ocean cannot carry us, let us venture onto its waters just to see." And there's a lot to see. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Big Ideas from the ABC.